everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn more about the PNWA, just head on over to pnwa.org. Sign up for their writers' conference. It's coming up this July. Oh, it's going to be a good one. Always is. Always is. And people are starting to sign up now, so the earlier you sign up, the more benefits there are. So head on over there. I was off last week. I was off last week. And so, but where was I? Well, I was down in Portland, down in the Willamette Writers, talking to the Willamette Writers, their Portland chapter. And it was a fabulous conversation we had down there. But I'm back, and I'm back with a most interesting fellow, Thomas Christopher Green. You know, Thomas would be interesting enough if this were just his fourth novel we're going to be talking about today, The Headmaster's Wife, and it is a good one. That would be interesting enough. That's really all I ever need to talk to someone. But Mr. Green also has an interesting day job. He is the president of the Vermont College of Fine Arts. But that is not all. He is not just the president of the Vermont College of Fine Arts. He is also the founder of that college. Are you intrigued? I am. Let's talk to him. Thomas, are you there? Welcome to the show.
I am, Bill. Thanks for having me. It's great to hear your voice.
Oh, it's good to hear yours, too. How is it going? This is book number 4. It's been out since February. How has it been going? How does it feel to have this baby out in the world?
It's been fabulous. It was a long time coming. You know, I haven't, my last novel was published in 2007. In between, as you referred to, I was starting and building a college here in Vermont. And so I think this one is actually the most gratifying experience I've had. And the reception of the novel has been tremendous, both from readers and reviewers. And it's really gotten out into the world and off to a really fast start. So I'm very excited.
That is awesome. Well, it well deserved. I'm not going to, it's got a number of twists in it, and I won't give them away, but it is not what you think, and it is a very compelling read. I highly recommend it. And so 2007 was when you released book number 3. That was the Mirror. Sorry, I'm trying to find my notes here. The Mirror, what
Envious
was number
Moon.
3?
Moon was my third
Envious
book.
Moon.
Mirror Lake was my first, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, so that was 2007. Now, between 2007 and 2014... you started a college, of all things, and that was what slowed down the writing process. What were you thinking? Why did you do that? You had a little career going. Why start a college?
Well, you know, sometimes naivete leads to great things, I think, and that was the case with me. You know, there's an old historic campus here in Montpelier, Vermont, my home, and it was in considerable trouble, and for the first time since 1868, there was a chance there would no longer be a college there. So it had an established MFA program. It had, in writing, it had a couple other programs, and they were in danger of being closed. And I'm a graduate of one of those programs, had friends who worked there. And so I began what initially felt like a bit of a quixotic effort to save a campus and save jobs, and we were successful. And now it's grown into a broader vision of creating a National Center for Education in the Arts here in Montpelier.
That's awesome. And, you know, you might have heard me in my intro, I say that, you know, what it takes to write the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. And it seems to me, how are these two experiences similar, writing a book and starting a college? Because, of course, it seems like you start a book and you've got this desire inside you that wants to be expressed, and there's tons of questions that aren't answered. And there must be something similar to starting a giant project like a college. You have numerous questions that need to be answered, but a desire inside you to see this thing exist. Did one experience inform the other? Did you feel yourself going to similar places to do
yes,
the college as you would to write a book?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to, you know, you have to live in some sort of state of denial to do either of those activities. in the sense that you also, you know, you need to keep your eye on the horizon of what you're trying to accomplish and do when you write a novel. But if you just do that, you'll never actually write because it's too damn intimidating.
Right.
I think the same is true of starting a college. You know, it's the accrual of small things that lead to the bigger things. So you focus on the sentence, you focus on the paragraph, you have an idea of the arc of the story you're trying to tell. And I think the same is true of building a college. It really was about storytelling. And for me, you know, the ability to be successful at the college was very similar to the success of writing a novel, which is that if you tell a good story, people will listen. Hopefully they'll pay attention to what you're saying, and ideally they'll follow you to a place you want to end up.
That's interesting. It was storytelling because you had to tell the story of why this should exist. What its value, what was the value of that college? And it's a narrative, really, because it's not a reality. I mean, it's just an idea in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and you have to convince a whole lot of people. I mean, you had to bring a lot of political capital, and Vermont's a great state because it's small. So, you know, when I was starting this, I could call up the governor and get a meeting, and I could go visit senators and people and tell them what we're trying to do. And you know, at first I thought people might look at me like I'm crazy, but they didn't. They thought it's a great idea, and we want to support you. And the more the support that came to it, the more real it became. And soon we owned a great classic New England campus, and, you know, we've got some of the top fine arts programs in the country, and the place is booming. So, and a lot of
that is about
getting people to believe.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But you have to do the same thing when you write your novel. You have to get your reader to believe, care about the story, believe in this reality that you've created, and be willing to go on that journey with you. You've got to teach them why what seems interesting to you could be interesting to them. Does that make sense?
I think exactly. I mean, John Gardner called it the fictional dream, that you create the fictional dream, and then you want people to really forget the experience of reading. You want them to see pictures, images, voices in their head, and I think all good fiction does that. And so part of that is creating that environment that people fall into and forget they're actually reading and engage with the story itself.
You know, you wrote a very moving afterword for this book, and it was begun in a very stressful time in your life also. And I'm not talking about the school, but also you had during the birth of a child who was born prematurely. Can you talk about what was going on at that point? And it was an odd time, it seemed to me, to start a book, and yet you did anyway.
Well, I mean, I think if you're a writer, you're always writing. But, you know, our second daughter, Jane, was born far too early. And she was 1 pound, 14 ounces at birth.
Wow.
And in some ways, she was a miracle. No one thought she was going to live the first day. She ended up living 6 months, never left the hospital. And so, you know, even though I was starting the college, of course, I spent a lot of time, as my wife did, down in the NICU at Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital in New Hampshire, where she was. And it was a surprisingly good place to write. I mean, there's a lot of noise in a NICU. I've always written in coffee shops and places like that. I like sort of ambient noise when I write. And there was a lot of time when she was sleeping. I mean, in many ways, she was a normal baby. She was just very sick. And, you know, what started as one novel, I think, became a very different one process.
Right. Well, and the book deals with grief, of course, and how sort of disorienting it is, I think. And so I can only assume that your own experience found its way in some way into this story.
Very much so. I mean, it's not, I've said it's the most honest thing I've ever written, but it's not autobiographical. I mean, instead, what I did was sort of try to channel a lot of what I was experiencing and feeling into the art and what I hope is art. And you know, I mean, I've always said about fiction that it's one of the only things that really obfuscates the truth in order to find a greater truth. And, you know, I'm hoping this book was able to do that. And I really drew on kind of a deep well of human feeling I had in putting it together.
Yeah, you said it was the most honest thing you'd ever written. When you think about, when you try to put into words what you did within yourself to write that honestly compared to what you've been doing before, because you weren't a hack before, you were trying to be honest, I'm sure. What matured in you? What changed in you that allowed that? What was the difference within yourself that happened? Do you think, or did something just crack open with the experience with your daughter?
Well, I mean, I think it was Shakespeare that said you haven't lived until you conceive of life as tragedy. And, you know, I have had a very charmed life in many ways, and I still do.
Right.
And, you know, this was really the trenches of life, to lose a child. There's nothing really more profound that, you know, in my experience, that you can imagine. And so, you know, I was really able to draw on that in a way I wasn't before. I mean, fiction fundamentally is an artifice. And so there is a piece of it where, you know, you're creating something that isn't true. But to the extent that you can draw on experience, knowledge, heartbreak, and really pour that into prose, I think you end up with a much stronger piece of work. And it wasn't as if I didn't do that before, but here I was really able to do it in a visceral way that I think really made a difference in the kind of book it is.
I wonder, was something closer to the surface, too? Sometimes you have to dig deep on, you know, into the well to get something, and sometimes it's just right there on the surface.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, this was a different book when I started it than when I ended it. And part of it was that experience of realizing where the heart of the book was. And it really was in this story of a marriage and in people. And, you know what I mean? I asked myself the question. My wife and I went through an incredibly traumatic experience, and we had to really, you know, relearn who each other were as part of that. And this book asked the question, well, what if you don't do that? What if instead of staying together, you somehow shatter like glass? And so that's sort of the fundamental thesis of what's happening in the novel.
Yeah, you know, a marriage, it seems to me, I've been talking to a lot of memoirists lately, and sometimes we talk about, they've been writing about marriage, and it seems to me a marriage, for it to work, it has to be about the two people willing to say, we're going to grow through this experience. I mean, you have I don't think you have a choice if you want the marriage to flourish, that you both have to be willing to change through the kind of crucible of the relationship, whether you have a kind of tragedy like you did or not, because you're going to have challenges regardless. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think, you know, the statistics are kind of overwhelming on people who lose a child. It's almost 80% of them get divorced.
Really?
And,
wow.
And
well, it doesn't surprise me.
It's much higher than, you know, the national average. And part of that is, you know, it is a very challenging time, and it's one where you have to come together, but it's also one where you have to deal with what it means for you. And I think I think having the benefit of being a writer and being able to express myself through the art, for me, was personally very cathartic and helpful.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, it's so critical, because I feel like, especially with the children, so my son was diagnosed on the autism spectrum, and so it was very challenging for us when we had to deal with schools and what it was like for him at home. But what really was challenging was the questions it brought up in ourselves about us, not just as parents, but as people, and what a human being is and what a human being isn't. And I'm grateful that I had the partner I did, that we were able to talk about those things and not let it, you know, not let those sort of burning questions actually pull us apart. Because you're really asking, because when a child passes, which my son didn't, but they were it reminds me of it in that you're forced to ask questions about life. And will you ask them together or apart, right? Are you going to ask them together and try and come together for that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that, you know, good fiction asks those questions anyway. And, you know, it gets at the heart of what it means to be human. And the heart of what it means to be human is ultimately about relationships. And so that's what I've always been interested in, is the way people interact with one another and the way people interact with one another, particularly, you know, when there's conflict.
So let's go back a little bit. When did you first recognize that stories mattered to you, that this was something, just story, period? It was something of interest and value to you.
Well, I didn't become a writer, I think, until I was about 18 years old. I wasn't one of those people who grew up being a writer. But, you know, I grew up in a big Irish Catholic family in Massachusetts. I'm one of seven kids. My parents were educators. We were a family that had dinner together every night. And storytelling was valued because storytelling was how you were heard and how you learned. And so I come from a family of storytellers, and just to compete with my siblings to get my parents' attention, sometimes you had to be interesting. So I think, you know, I come from a family of storytellers, and so that was always important to me. But it wasn't something I ever contemplated that you could actually do. you know, and we all have that moment as writers where you decide, you read something, you say, you know what, maybe I could do that. And that didn't happen to me until I was probably 18, 19 years old.
And what did you read that triggered that reaction in you?
Oddly, and it's not a book that's among my favorites now, but it was Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And I remember reading that novel and seeing, and I guess this gets the heart of your show here, but, you know, the way he integrated his writing into his life and sort of writing down experience. And I thought, you know, that really intrigues me, the idea that I can connect these two things together, that I can make art out of just the act of living itself.
Yeah, it's true. I always think that one of the most beautiful things about what we call literary fiction is because the genres, the real hard genres, tend to deal with very dramatic events that most of us won't go through. And one of the things I like about, again, what we call literary fiction is that it says that everything matters. Every moment conceivably matters if you turn your eye to it in a certain way. Does that resonate with you?
It does. I mean, I think it's about the stuff of life, and I think that, you know, if you're an observer of life and you're someone who, you know, I mean, they say about the Irish, you should be able to go to the post office and come back with a good story. And I think that there's a fundamental truth to that for my perspective, that I try to see the world with an open set of eyes and try to understand where people are coming from and what their motivations are and what drives them. And turning that into something that interests other people, I think, is one of the most important things we can do, and certainly probably our oldest art form.
Yeah. Did your relationship to reading changed once you really became essentially a professional writer, once you started publishing books and this is really what you did every day, tell your own stories? Did your relationship to the books you read begin to change, or are those two separate, such separate experiences that it didn't affect the other?
No, it changed a lot, and I think, I mean, I read very differently now. I mean, I read like a reader, and I read to find out what happens, and I read to discover, and I like being swept away by a story, but at the same time, I do read as a writer, in which I deconstruct books that I read and try to see how people put them together and how they function.
Yeah.
And I think it also transcends to other parts of life. You listen differently. You know, if you're in a restaurant, or, you know, you overhear conversations, and you train your ear to hear them as dialogue and the way people actually talk.
Yeah. Yeah, because dialogue is so funny. Dialogue is such an art because it has to sound like conversation, but, of course, if you wrote down a conversation the way people said it, it would be horrible. For the most part, it wouldn't work. And so you have to capture that balance that actually sounds like conversation but is not the way, the kind of rambling way people tend to talk.
Yeah, I think you have to be very selective. Yeah, I think you have to be very selective in what you use because it has to serve the story and it has to move it forward. So it's a real process of editing out the chafe.
Because if you ever hear like those, if you ever read like, you know, they do transcripts from courtrooms or from phone conversations filled with us and dot, 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 and you can't, all that's got to go. So, all right, so this is book number four. And you mentioned in it that it changed a lot. It changed a lot. And so talk about that the discovery that the writer goes through. That, you know, it's your book, you've had the idea, and yet the thing seems to change underneath you in a way, doesn't it? Or almost despite you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a process of discovery writing a novel, I think. And I wish there were faster ways to do it. I start with a germ of an idea, and I end up writing the first 100 pages as many as 4 or 5 times in completely different fashions. I've compared it to calibrating a lock and trying to hit that perfect point where you know you're going to be able to carry the story all the way through. And the only way to do that really is to write it. You know, you put the clay on the table, and then you start to mold it. And for me, this started as a story I wanted to write. You know, a story with a background of the Iraq War and about a soldier coming home, and I hadn't been in Iraq and I wasn't a soldier, and I ended up writing a very different story after the experience with our daughter. But you know, I think the novel itself is really a story of love ultimately, even though there's a lot of challenges in it.
Yeah, you know, I have another New Englander on the line here, I think, who wants to ask you a question. Is that you, Jeffrey?
Yeah, Bill, should I say Khan, Ba?
if you'd like.
You, my friend, wonderful guest. So nice to meet you, Thomas. Thank you for your friendship today on Facebook.
Happy to do it.
Thank you so much again. Via Beth Fish, I had the exceptional experience in being deeply moved by your video about the loss of your daughter you recorded at the University of Vermont. In that talk, you said so wonderfully and with such truth, grief in so many ways is quite universal, and there are things we all experience and can share. In other ways than your beautifully written novel, The Headmaster's Wife, were you able to share that experience with others and to feel a sense of common ground and healing?
Oh, good question, Jeff. Yeah. How about that?
I think that's a great question. And, the video is referring to, I think people can find online, but I was asked to address the annual children's service at the University of Vermont of parents who lost their children. I wasn't able to actually be there in person because of scheduling, so I did it by video. And initially I was reluctant to do that talk because I felt that grief was so particular. And what do I have to say to someone who lost a 17-year-old? You know, I had my daughter for 6 months and not 17 years, and I thought there's a difference there. But I did come to terms with the idea that there is a universality to it and that we all experience certain things and how we overcome it. And someday the sun shines and you're a different person again and you've moved beyond it even though it's always a part of you. And I did really want to put that into this book and understand it. And so particularly through the character of the headmaster's wife, Elizabeth, who plays a bigger role in the second half of the novel than the first, I think I was able to channel a lot of what I had learned personally and what I felt personally. And I think that's one of the reasons people are responding the way they are to this book.
Yeah, yes, I'm sure it is. Whenever we can bring our most honest and vulnerable self to the page, the thing that is so personal to us, I have found it often has the most universal appeal, ironically. You know?
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that's very true. And it, in some ways it's counterintuitive because we think our thoughts
right.
are so specific.
Yeah.
And there's a challenge, and there's a challenge as writers to do that because, you know, you still have to make it interesting. And, you know, if just because everybody experiences things a certain same way doesn't necessarily make it interesting because people want new insight into it. So
that's
part
right.
of it is, you know, hitting that common ground where there's an understanding that, yes, this is, I know this feeling, I know what this is like, but at the same time I'm hearing it for the first time.
That's right. When you say it, when you let it go through you, when you let the observation of grief go through you, the observation of love go through you, the observation of fear or lust or whatever go through you, it has to come out new because it's coming through you. If it comes through you, honestly, it has to be new. I'm sorry. Because you're new. Because there's never been a Thomas Christopher Green before. Am I right?
Right. I think you're right. It's all perspectival. And so it's where you sit and how you explain it exactly.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so, all right, so great. This wonderful novel, you wrote it differently. It was a long time in the writing of it, but now it's done and it's out there in the world. So when you come to have you started book number 5 yet?
I have.
Okay, you don't have
really
to tell me about it.
<I won't. laughs>
Don't tell me about it. But when you what was different when you started it? Did you feel, was there anything you came to it differently based on what you learned in writing Headmaster's Wife? Or was it just back to square one, doesn't matter?
I always find the blank page really intimidating at first, and I never hit a comfort stride with a book until I'm, you know, really on top of it, and that's usually about halfway through a significant draft. And I remember Jeffrey Lent, who's a writer, used to live in Vermont, that I knew, said to me once, you know, you never know when it's going to go away, and this thing we do, and whether it's going to be there when you sit down, and how scary that is. And so every time I approach it new, I think, how did I do this before? And then you just it's just a matter of one foot in front of the other, and you hope it comes together in the end.
Yeah, that's what Alice Hoffman said when I interviewed her. She said, and you know, she's done like 28 novels. I don't know how many. She said, every time she starts a book, she thinks, I don't know how to do this. Every time. She said, I don't know how to write a book. There's that blank page. Because you know why it must be, though? Because you haven't written the book you're about to write, and it's not the last book.
It's infuriating.
Yeah, but if it was the same, if it was just painting by numbers each time, wouldn't you just get bored anyway? Wouldn't you?
Well, there's nothing I think so. And the reward is amazing. And I don't mean the reward of publishing and the rest of it and getting paid for art, which is great. And I celebrate that all the time. But it's more the reward is in when you do cross that bridge, wherever it is within the book, and you know you have full command of the story. And that is an extraordinary feeling, and that's what I chase.
It's great, isn't it? And how many times, how many times in the course of that book do you think, maybe you never do, but I know I do, I think, I'm never going to find it. This is going to be the one. I'm not going to find it. It's not going to be there. This is a white whale. I'm just going to take me down. Or do you always know it's out there somewhere?
I think it's out there somewhere. It's just a matter of looking for it, and that is the process of doing the work. And there's a reason we call it work. And you know, someone once told me the greatest gift you can give is your labor, and it is labor to write a novel. It's not the labor a lot of people do every day. You know, really hard labor, but it's labor that, you know, I think has lasting value if you get it right.
Absolutely. Well, we're coming down to the last few minutes, and I'd love to ask you one more question. Looks like we have time. So what I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me that stories are important, that, mm-hmm. as I said at the end of my first book, that in the end all we are stories. All we can ever be are stories. And when you believe that fully, you can no longer be afraid and you can no longer be alone.
Oh, I love that. We are. It's absolutely true, Thomas. I think that life is a story we're telling ourselves. Life is just a story we're telling. What is that great Muriel Rukeyser quote that she said, the universe, I think she said in terms of for humans, the universe is not made of atoms but of very small stories.
That's right, and I think that is exactly right. And I think if you have something to say, then you should say it. And I think the thing that constantly surprises me is that there's a whole lot of people who want to listen.
There are. If you speak honestly, I want to listen. That's for sure. And if you can speak honestly, they will want to listen for sure. It seems impossible at your desk where it's all quiet and just you all alone. But in fact, right, when it gets out there.
It's a wonderful thing, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be able to do it. And you know, publishing is a team sport, and there's a lot of criticism on the world that publishing is changing and is done. I might be old-fashioned, but I'm so happy with this experience and with all the people who have supported me on this book.
Absolutely. Well, it was clearly everybody was on board with this because it came out great. Guinness, the headmaster's wife. So, Thomas, thank you so much. It's been great having you on the show.
Hey, Bill, it's been my pleasure. I really appreciate your interest.
Oh, no problem. All right, everyone. Oh, life is a story. Life is a story. And if it's a story, you've got to tell the best one you can. Story you want. You can tell it. You tell it to yourself. You tell it to your friends and your lovers and your family. It's just a story we're telling ourselves. What is the story you want to tell? You can tell anyone you want. Tell it in a page. Tell it on a blog. Tell it just in a conversation. It's a story. It's a story. It's a story. All right. Well, listen, thank you all very much. I'll be here next week. I can't remember who my guest is. It doesn't matter. I'll be here. It'll be fabulous. But until then, as always, write what you love. Talk about what you love, listen to what you love, and you can't go wrong. No, you can't.